يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
جيروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
راشا ساقلم اسطنبول
سيد امين علمي كابول
شهان بات اندين ادمنستيرد كشمير
Around the world with reporters.
The Nigerian Senate said the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, is accused of sponsoring terrorist groups, including the Nigerian insurgent group Boko Haram. The Nigerian legislative body said this is a weighty allegation which should be thoroughly investigated. The lawmaker said USAID and other non-governmental organizations had given many Nigerians cause to question their motives in the troubled northeast of Nigeria. Leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Jazaki, has always said that the United States and other Western countries are complicit in the sponsor of Boko Haram terrorists in Nigeria. Boko Haram is an insurgent group that started in 2009 and has killed tens of thousands of Nigerians in frequent brutal attacks. Over 2 million Nigerians have been displaced from their homes, in addition to destruction of hospitals, schools, and basic infrastructure by Boko Haram. The allegation that said that USAID is sponsoring Boko Haram, another terrorist, came as a startling revelation to many Nigerians, but experts are not surprised.
When you look at the antecedents of the United States, you see that they have been involved in either financing or stoking ember of discord around the world, only to further their own cause. For example, after they damaged Libya, damaged Iraq, and tried to damage Afghanistan, this was when they began to send in their military-industrial complexes.
Experts argue that if allegations of USAID sponsoring terrorism prove true, it would be a striking irony. The United States has long presented itself as a global leader in counterterrorism, but such a revelation would severely undermine its moral authority on the world stage. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
The Zulfiqar military exercises officially begun in southern Iran, covering the Mokran coasts, the Oman Sea, and the northern Indian Ocean. All four branches of the country's military units, with their infantry, armored and mechanized forces, along air defense systems, warships, and submarines, are involved. These drills are designed to enhance Iran's readiness and strengthen its defensive capabilities against any potential threat.
The goal of these exercises is to strengthen our defense and deterrence capabilities against any ground, air, or maritime threats, while also testing new tactics. By conducting such drills, we'll be evaluating new, smart, and precise weapons and ammunition, including all types of domestically made missiles. Special attention will also be given to critical and current issues, such as electronic warfare, cyber operations, drones, and emerging technologies that could change the battlefield.
As the drills unfold, a significant phase has already taken place, focused on intelligence-based operations and reinforcing security measures. This exercise is laying the foundation for more advanced operational phases, with further drills set to test everything from air and ground coordination to high-tech defense systems. Key moments during the exercises include the successful interception of an enemy drone by a MiG-29 fighter jet and airstrikes carried out by F-4E bombers. Additionally, submarine-launched torpedoes and advanced helicopter operations have also shown the ever-growing strength of Iran's naval capabilities.
These maneuvers highlight Iran's self-reliance through its advanced and domestically built arsenal, while also underscoring its commitment to strengthening its military capabilities and ensuring readiness to respond to any changes in the region. Ali Ramazani, Kalat.
Arriving to a hero's welcome, Ben Jamal,
director of the UK-based Palestine Solidarity Campaign, appears at his pre-trial, charged with public order offenses following a major pro-Palestine rally in London last month, which he was an organizer of. Supporters say he was unfairly charged.
I'd like them to dismiss this as ridiculous charges, the whole thing, and just let him walk free.
We want the court to drop all charges against Ben Jamal, not just Ben Jamal, but every single person who's been unjustly arrested by the police over the last 16 months. There's been so many arrests, and they've been politically motivated.
The demonstration in question took place on January 18th. The Metropolitan Police had approved the organizers' proposed route from the BBC's headquarters to Whitehall, but reversed course ahead of the march, saying it would disturb services at a synagogue.
It's a complete and utter fabrication. There have been no threats to synagogues or to Jewish worshippers. Every single demonstration has had hundreds and hundreds of Jewish protesters. If there was even the slightest threat to Jews or to synagogue worshippers, those same Jewish protesters and thousands of others would do all we could to protect the synagogue, to protect Jews, because fundamentally, these Palestine demonstrations are anti-racist, against all racism, including anti-Semitism.
The pressure to clamp down on the Palestine Solidarity protest came from pro-Israel groups like the Board of Deputies of British Jews, pro-Israel MPs, and Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis, who has supported Israel's use of force against Palestinians. In addition to their outrage over the 77 arrests on January 18th, the protesters here say they're worried about their right to protest.
We saw the Public Order Act brought in by the Conservative government, which brought in loads of powers to continue to suppress and oppress the right to protest and make it more and more difficult for people to protest. And, you know, lots of people called that out at the time. That was a Conservative policy, but it's something that's been upheld by the Labour government, and I think that's what's really terrifying. And we are lots of people saying that we're taking a step back and moving into incredibly dark times.
In the same month as those arrests, Britain saw Israeli General Oded Bazhyak and his delegation visiting the UK with special diplomatic immunity. A member of the Israeli military, Bazhyak was involved in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its offensive in southern Lebanon.
This is arguably a dangerous moment for British democracy. That fear shared by the protesters here who say they feel they live in a country that grants diplomatic immunity to war criminals who oversaw genocide, and yet it persecutes those who organized peaceful protests aimed solely at stopping that very genocide. Saeed Pourreza, London.
After almost 1 month of the ceasefire in Gaza, life has not changed a lot, particularly for people here in Deir el-Balah, which was once the main haven for the displaced people. A lot of families here, hundreds of families, are still stranded in tents, in leaky and dilapidated tents, with no means of protection at all. People here are desperate for water, food, and every essential need. However, they are without anything, without any life means inside their tents. And their suffering is being doubled and tripled and even quadrupled because of the continuously dropping temperatures and the low pressure fronts expected to hit the territory in the coming weeks. Now, for them, as Israel is still obstructing the aid and the entry of caravans and mobile homes into Gaza, they don't know how they can cope with the current situation. And their only solution is just to take shelter in those dilapidated and flimsy tents, which are easily flooded and blown away by the strong waves of wind and the torrential rain.
Our home is no longer standing. Our home and four other houses are above each other. We can't use anything in our home. There are no intact houses here. You can barely find four. Living in tents is truly difficult and unbearable. Today, the rainwater filled our tents, so we sank in garbage and mud.
Our home was destroyed along with other four houses. The area there was bulldozed. The Israeli military is still present in our residential area. We can't bear taking shelter in tents because we are surrounded by garbage. We have drowned today due to the heavy rain which flooded our tents and wetted our clothes.
Surrounded by stagnant pools of sewage and garbage and trapped in a bubble of endless trauma, hundreds of Palestinian families are still taking refuge in their damp and leaky tents in Deir el-Balah, as their homes have been destroyed by the Israeli military and the residential areas are still beleaguered by Israeli forces. Despite all the horrors they have been through, they're trying to alleviate the grim reality of living after the ceasefire. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir el-Balah, Gaza.
Relying only on their phones, Bisan Auda and Ahmed Ghunem, known as Ahmed Alive, put the genocide in Gaza by Israel on display for the world to see. In a documentary by former war correspondent and Scene Palestine TV co-founder Yusuf Omar, the journey of two resilient journalists in Gaza breaks through the selective reporting of the Western mainstream media. In its New York screening, the double feature relayed raw footage filmed by Bisan and Ahmed documenting the genocide as it unfolds. The producer, Yusuf Omar, told us many of his screenings were canceled in Canada and the U.S. after venues called the film political, as he delved into the issue of media hypocrisy.
When they found out that we were showcasing Palestinian films from Gaza, for various reasons, they decided, hey, we can't work with you anymore. And it's just really sad. I think when you hear about North America, you think about it as like freedom of expression and like a free press. We go to journalism conferences around the world and you see the media crying their eyes out when they speak about Ukraine. But yet when you hear about journalists out of Gaza losing their lives, nothing. Absolute silence. The hypocrisy is absolutely insane. We've seen, as you say, over 200 journalists have been killed. It is the most dangerous place on earth to be a journalist. More journalists have been killed in Gaza than at any point in recently recorded history.
At least 217 journalists have been killed since October 7, 2023 by Israel. And yet, those crimes have not been accounted for, nor have the occupation and its allies been held accountable, especially as much as the media polishes it.
The reason why Israel get away with it is because they are their own police. When the U.S. are asked about these crimes, they say, well, Israel are investigating it. That's like the criminal investigating, or it's like the criminal being the judge in their own case. The ability for content and journalism and storytelling to change hearts and minds is quite an incredible thing. People underestimate it. For so long, traditional media has dehumanized Arab populations, and that's how we've helped create consent for a genocide. People are craving raw, real, authentic voices from the ground, and that's why we're working with all these citizens.
Scene Palestine is working with 50 storytellers in Gaza from the youngest age of 12, using their phones to reveal both the tragic reality on the ground and the brave spirits of the children creating life again from the rubble. The targeting of journalists in Gaza and in Lebanon has been blatantly ignored by preachers of international law. Nevertheless, and despite threats, both Bisan and Ahmed refuse to be silenced by conspiring governments and the mainstream media as they embody the true meaning of journalism. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
We are currently inside the Al Jawaziat security compound, which is located in the central area of Gaza City, documenting how the situation looks like after the Israeli occupation forces targeted this place and this area for multiple times. We are still witnessing and documenting this massive and widespread destruction and devastation inflicted in this area. Buildings were targeted, destroyed, and leveled to the ground by the Israeli tanks and the Israeli F-16 fighter jets. Wherever we turn our camera, we can document how the Israeli forces deliberately targeted the buildings of this compound. This compound was the main security compound in Gaza Strip because it included several departments, several security agencies. So it's not worthy that targeting this compound hasn't taken place far away from targeting the policemen in the streets, the individuals were responsible for securing the humanitarian supplies. I cannot read exactly what is written down here in the Hebrew language, but it appears that these are the messages the Israeli forces wanted to deliver the Palestinian people, trying desperately to show more force and dominance.
Definitely, the main aim of targeting the security buildings was creating a chaotic situation and pushing the people to rebel against Hamas ruling. The Israeli drones were enabling the looters and gangs to move freely and steal the humanitarian aid, while the law enforcement individuals and policemen were targeted intentionally. It's all systematic.
So, as you can see right now, we have some explosive war remnants that were left behind the Israeli occupation forces. It's noteworthy that thousands of those objects are still scattered elsewhere in Gaza Strip. Unequivocally, targeting the security agencies, departments, and buildings was completely systematic by the Israeli occupation forces. And it came in the context of the fixed policy used and adopted by the Israeli regime in order to create more chaos on the ground here in Gaza Strip and targeting the internal front of the Palestinian people. Mutab Musabbeh, Gaza City.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians remain displaced in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp as an Israeli offensive there enters its second month. The displaced residents gathered at the eastern entrance of the Jenin camp to retrieve what remains of their necessities. Israeli forces, however, prevented them from even approaching the camp after initially allowing them to go there.
We went after the occupation, coordinated with the Palestinian liaison so that we could enter the camp. But after we gathered, they prevented us. We were displaced since the first day because we were trapped in Ibn Sina Hospital, and I have been unable to enter the camp since Tuesday when the special forces came in. We miss our lives and homes in the camp very much. We wish we could have stayed and not been displaced. We were displaced to the area surrounding the camp, but the camp remains dear to us.
As the Israeli assault continues, the extent of the widespread destruction of homes and other properties in different parts of Jenin and its refugee camp is becoming clearer each day. Regime forces, at the same time, are sending military reinforcements along with bulldozers and fuel tankers to the camp and its surrounding areas.
I'm going to check on my home that was burned down. My house was completely burned. I am the aunt of the martyr Ibrahim al-Kunairi and the aunt of the martyr Rahab al-Ashkar, whose body was held for 10 days. It's sorrow upon sorrow. I have no shelter or place to settle after this displacement.
According to the United Nations, the current mass displacement is unprecedented in the occupied West Bank over the past years. That comes as Israel has expanded its Jenin offensive to other areas in the northern West Bank.
As the operation moved into its second month, thousands are fleeing Jenin due to the ongoing demolitions by the Israeli army, marking the largest displaced in decades across the occupied West Bank. Tiba Asi, occupied Jenin.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the commanders of the Iran's Air Force and Air Defense Force. The meeting took place on February 7th, 2025, in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on the anniversary of the historic Air Force commander's pledge of allegiance to Imam Khomeini in 1979. Negotiations with the United States have no effect on solving the country's problems. Of course, there are problems inside the country. No one denies that problems exist. There are many problems in people's livelihoods. Almost all segments of society face hardships and challenges. However, that which solves these problems is an internal factor. The internal factor is the determination of committed Iranian officials and the cooperation of a united Iranian nation. This is exactly what you will witness in the upcoming rally, God willing, the unity of the people. Every year, the rally on 22nd of Bahman is a demonstration of national unity in our country. A perceptive nation and indefatigable officials are what will solve our problems. The officials are busy working. Praise God, they are getting things done. And I am very hopeful that this esteemed administration will at least be able to ease people's difficulties in their livelihood and remove their hardships. The US is sitting and redrawing the map of the world on paper. But it's only on paper and has no relation to reality whatsoever. They make comments about us, talk, give opinions, and issue threats. If they threaten us, we will threaten them. If they carry out their threat, we will carry out our threat. If they disrupt the security of our nation, we will definitely disrupt their security as well. This approach is taken from the Quran, is the command of Islam, and is our duty. We hope Almighty God grants us success in carrying out our duties.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
April 26th, 2022. I used to go to the University of Tehran every week, without any exception. This dates back to 40 years ago, not now. There, students would gather and pose their questions, and I would provide answers. Thus, many problems would be resolved, and many feelings would be expressed. In certain cases, there were no answers for the criticisms made, and we understood that there was a need for something to be done. Such problems must be resolved. I have advised officials in various organizations and ministers to come and hold discussions with you. Well, the General Staff of the Armed Forces and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were mentioned here. These organizations must step forward and speak. Many of these criticisms can be explained. Of course, in certain cases, there may not be good explanations, and the other side will understand the need for taking action in that regard. This is a point that I wanted to raise so that you will take it into consideration.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
coming us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. After nearly 5 months, the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, has finally had a long-awaited foreign proper funeral procession in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. His body on display next to his deputy, Hashem Safieddine, both martyred in September and October of last year, respectively, by the Zionist U.S. war machine. As thousands of people have flown into Beirut to join tens of thousands to pay tribute to a man who led Hezbollah for over three decades. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah strove to preserve the integrity and territory of Lebanon, to protect Palestinians against Zionist occupation and aggression, and even protected Syria from foreign-backed terrorism. His life and legacy is what we'll be discussing in tonight's installment of your Spotlight. And now for our guests. Joining us is Batul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from London. And Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political analyst, also joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess, Batul, we'll start with you. Condolences to you for the passing of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, for Sayed Hashim Safieddine. Your initial thoughts on the life and legacy of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah.
Right. He was a leader who ultimately had a deep love and connection in the hearts of the masses, even before their minds. He penetrated their hearts. The people have maintained the same momentum, the same strength, enthusiasm, and love over quite a long period of time, from since the early 1990s until 2024. His love has never diminished, nor has his popularity amongst his followers and supporters. On the contrary, his influence has only grown. It's expanded, it's spread, until it's now reached all corners of the world, making him ultimately a legendary symbol and an icon in thought, just as he was in the hearts of many. Sayed Nasrallah was destined to exist in a region that is filled with deception, where political action was not genuine, but merely the reception of orders from external forces. Yet he stood as the true model, confronting the great but unjust and malevolent powers that dominate. And so his path became a beacon for all liberation movements worldwide, imposing itself on the political landscape of the region and setting a standard that ultimately others find difficult to reach. Sayed Nasrallah was a man who elevated and advanced everything around him. Under him, Lebanon became the focus of global attention. And everyone, I mean everyone, benefited from his contributions. His influence was not only limited to his supporters alone. Even his enemies and his adversaries began to adopt his methods of work, his political maneuvering, seeking to refine their performance and to elevate their political actions. And so due to his immense influence, it was expected that inevitably he would be met with an equal counterforce. If you want to know the value of something, look at what's standing in the way of it. In this case, it was 84 tons of explosives on his body.
Thank you, Batul. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, welcome to the program. good to have you join us. Our first off, our condolences to once again for Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashim Saifuddin's passing. Your initial thoughts on the late Hezbollah leader's legacy and the charismatic persona that's going to stay with us for years ahead.
Yes, my condolences to all of humanity, because Sayyid Nasrallah was not just for the Lebanese people. He wasn't just a figure who stood for the Hezbollah movement. He is someone, I think, who transcends all of these boundaries and barriers. In the end, what really shines for me is that virtually every one of the resistance axis leaders, you'll note one thing that they have in common. They have a prophetic virtue ethics. You know, you look at Sheikh Zakzaki, who was there today, you look at Sayyid Khamenei, you look at any of the leaders, name any of them that are prominent, even within the movement of the Houthis, and you will see this one shining value which comes out, which is their virtues, is their honor, their sacrifice, their loyalty, their sense of love and respect. But also, they then embody and represent role models which actually people don't just follow as political leaders, but in reality, they follow them as good human beings. So whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim, if you really get beyond the Israeli Hasbara, which is obviously widespread across the world, what you'll find is a man who represents the most wholesome of personalities, of men. And I think that's the big takeaway. And that's why you can't destroy a man like Sayyid Nasrallah. You can't kill him because he's an institution in his own right now. And he's as a martyr, you know, we Muslims, obviously, we know very well that martyrs don't die. And so all that's happened is through this martyrdom is that Israelis have really really put a nail in their coffin, which is very, very secure. I mean, the reality of the matter is that Israel now, if you look at what they've done, yes, okay, you've killed Sayyid Safaddin, you've killed Sayyid Nasrallah, but what have you bought in return? You've bought $67 billion of loss, an Eilat port which is bankrupt, hundreds of thousands displaced. You've bought yourself a defeat at the hands of a barely trained Palestinian resistance, and you've got a million or so Israelis who have now done an exodus. And at the end, what they achieved is a labeling of them as terrorists on a level which has never been seen before. You know, the terrorism they did in terms of the pagers that they detonated amongst the Lebanese civilian population, that has not gone from their memory. But all of this is thanks, I think, very much to the steadfastness of Sayyid Nasrallah, his ability to convert Hezbollah from being simply a little military set of cells, operating in a kind of resistance mode, which also ultimately defeated a 15-year Israeli occupation, to actually a force which not only provided social services, medical services, served Christian, Muslim, whoever, which actually gave the Lebanese a sense of, protection and safety. But he's also fought for the freedom of the Syrians, sadly, something which hasn't lasted. But we can't forget that the levels of victories which Sayyid Nasrallah has overseen are too innumerable to mention within one program. But I'll try and get back to more of them, perhaps in later questions.
Right. And Batul, would you like to weigh in on that? How do you see Sayyid Hassan's impact on not just Lebanese, but also regional resistance over the past 30 plus years?
Yes, absolutely. In terms of Lebanon and the region, so he spared the country of Lebanon from civil war by preventing it and refusing to basically be dragged into strife. He raised the level of revolutionary movements as they strove to match him. He provided all the parties' expertise to the surrounding resistance movements in the region with boundless generosity. There was selflessness. He prioritized them, even if they disagreed with him. There was an exchange of expertise, generosity in giving. So Sayyid Nasrallah ultimately elevated Lebanon to another level as well. Sayyid Nasrallah kept the global powers on edge. They were constantly concerned. The weight of the resistance necessitated an equivalent counterweight from the West. So they mobilized all of their machinery to attack the resistance throughout these years. and the counterweights were not in equal measure. And so that ultimately allowed them to advance. We saw how the colonial forces moved to defend their pet project Israel, the occupation entity. We saw how Sayyidina Nasrallah turned the previously prevailing surrender in the region prior to 1982, when the resistance was formed, into an arena of active confrontation that effectively kicked the Zionists out in 2000 and liberated the country. There had been some confrontations prior to 1982, but ultimately he came and he gave it an authentic and effective, a sincere and a significantly more serious dimension. Sayyid awakened the consciousness of the nation and the religious path that was asleep. Instead, he activated the religious path of sacrifice. For this reason, he, you know, constantly focused on the topic of Imam Hussein and martyrdom within his speeches, you know, considering the Imam to be a pioneer of liberation movements and the ultimate model who sacrificed himself for the survival and for the salvation and the revival of the nation. So he, Sayyid Nasrallah, revived this through his martyrdom. And we're seeing that the nation has ultimately been revived through the slogans that he raised during his lifetime, which after his death has now been turned into a kind of flood. It's been turned into a volcano. For when a leader sacrifices himself, that's when the concepts transform into life and movement within the people. So what's happened is you've got a quantity of people who have now turned into mass quality. And the taxation for this transformation process is ultimately the blood.
Thank you. And Sayyid, Sayyid's a leadership. How do you see his persona, which obviously shined through his leadership, how do you see it having impacted over the years the spiritual and political trajectory of not just Hezbollah, but also the military strength of the Lebanese resistance movement?
Well, of course, Lebanon is very cosmopolitan. There are Christians, Druze, and there are Sunni Muslims. So it's a very diverse society. And I think one of the things that's underestimated is how Sayyid Nasrallah managed to navigate this entire cosmopolitan environment with a spiritual character and with a religious identity still intact. And yet he's managed to win friends and create unity and keep that country as together as possible. Because don't forget, before the emergence of Hezbollah and before Israel had occupied that land, there had been an absolutely devastating war, a vicious internal civil war. So getting Lebanon not to spiral back into that has been a major achievement by Sayyid Nasrallah, by basically, even though he was politically, as a party, were powerful and strong and were dominant, really. But he didn't impose that domination. He tried to work in a fraternal way with all the forces. And he's also offered Hezbollah sacrifices of his men for the sake of Lebanon, where others haven't stood up. Let's face it, the Lebanese army itself has done next to nothing or had to do next to nothing because Hezbollah have done that. And all of this, ultimately, when you talk about his personality, this man, rather like all the other Hezbollah warriors and even the ones before him, even stretching back as far as Abbas Mousavi or Sayyid Moussa Sadr, all of these leaders, if you look within the Lebanon fraternity, Imad Mughniya, they were all forged in the crucible of conflict. They were forged in wars, sieges, assassination attempts, relentless psyops. Sayyid Nasrallah, more so than anybody, you know, he survived so many assassination attempts, and he had to live this life of basically a kind of a warrior in constant daily recognition that he could be killed at any time. But he embraced that. He sacrificed his own son as well during the course of this process, and he was a real living example for the Lebanese people. And let's face it, across the Muslim world, the temptation for Muslims to wilt and to become neoliberal, to go for the materialist line, to buy into the American so-called dream, to do what the Saudis and to do what the Kuwaitis and all the other Khaliji Arabs have been doing for decades now, basically selling their souls to the devil, siphoning off the money of their nations, selling out their people, selling off their dignity, serving in humiliation to an Anglo-Zionist empire, trying to normalize with Israel. You see, Sayyid Nasrullah gave the Arabs pride. I say the Arabs because, of course, prior to this, there'd been no victory by any Arab army against Israel. It's Sayyid Nasrullah and the victories of 2000 and 2006, which really decimated Israeli invincibility. And he's continued to do that because in this particular round, Sayyid Nasrullah's tactics and the training of his army has led to basically IDF again, or the IOF, I should call it, being again humiliated. They couldn't move virtually, you know, a matter of meters or inches into the territory of Lebanon beyond what has allowed them to. They basically were unable to achieve any of their objectives of reoccupying Lebanon, all because of the organization, the military organization, which was there, which was done under the auspices of Sayyid Nasrullah. The political organization held Lebanon together. And the reality of the matter is, in this last war, I don't think that Israel would have achieved even the ceasefire that they begged, basically, to get going, had it not been for the fact that they were bombing civilians, and also civilians who weren't necessarily Hezbollah civilians. So they were killing people who were Christians and others in order to make them tell Hezbollah, beg Hezbollah to stop their missile attacks on Tel Aviv. And what we saw in this last war was nowhere is safe in Israel, just as Sayyid Nasrullah promised. If you looked carefully before Israel finally had to bend to the truce, was basically that Hezbollah were violating, maybe 400 or 500 missiles were violating Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Haifa. They were violating these territories constantly. So all I saw during my lifetime of watching Sayyid Nasrullah was a man who was victorious on a personal level in the terms of his people and in terms of the oppressed in the region. And for that, one has to just constantly laud the leadership and the power and the kind of pride which is reinstilled within all the oppressed in that region.
Thank you, Sayyid. And Batul, why was the occupation so threatened by Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, where, to Sayyid's point, they tried so many times over the years to assassinate him, where they leveled an entire city block in Dahiyeh in late September for his martyrdom?
Right. Ultimately, because the goal of political action is to reach the public and to turn objectives into a movement. With Sayyid Nasrullah, we saw truth in an era of deception. We saw truth in the sense of real action, truth in the sense of ideology and methodology. This led to achievements that were building up. Sayyid Nasrullah created an undefeatable party, regardless of the battles. Defeat is merely the feeling of being defeated, but he led the transformation, activating the immense latent heritage in people's beliefs into movement, you know, in the same way that Imam Khomeini did this through the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So this heritage was not created by Sayyid Nasrullah, but his role was in its activation. He created a party that ultimately refined souls, changed mindsets. He elevated the level of political engagement domestically. Everyone sought to catch up with him and to emulate him. And ultimately, the goal of political parties is to reach the public with their ideas. You know, they strive through speeches, through publications, through seminars, to influence, to elevate people's awareness to a certain level. And Sayyid Nasrullah, ultimately, we see this with his blood. We see the power of Sayyid Nasrullah when he was alive through his blood. We see today how his blood has transformed the nation from this mass quantity of people into quality. And the blood is the necessary price to pay for this transformation. It's the taxation of this process. And the crowds that we saw today, you know, this nation that we saw today, they would have come out in their masses also if they knew that Sayyid Nasrullah was going to be with them speaking in public. It's not the case that because he's been killed that they're coming out. No, if he was actually coming out to meet the people and to greet them, they would have come out in their hundreds of thousands as well. And so this crowd that we saw today, it cannot be subdued under any circumstances. That nation will reach its goals because it follows this path, it possesses this vision, it carries the spirit. Today we're at a stage where the resistance party's body has advanced beyond its leadership. And we see that the masses who rally behind the resistance have advanced even beyond the party's body after deeply internalizing its principles. The bloodshed has turned their beliefs, the beliefs of the masses, into real momentum. So through turning the Secretary General into a martyr, The party's body has become stronger and more driven than its leadership, and its public have become more driven than the party's body. And for this reason, you see that the resistance, without even giving orders, it relied on the masses to go to the south of Lebanon, to go to the border, to confront the Israeli tanks at zero distance, and to ultimately liberate the villages of the south with their bare flesh. Mm. In the face of that, what is the enemy able to do?
And Sayed, what did we learn today from this epic turnout for the funeral procession of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, of Sayed Hashem Safieddine in Beirut and elsewhere, in Iran, in Iraq, even in Kuwait, in Bahrain, in Yemen, all over the world, there are simultaneous processions that took place today. And what do we learn from these?
Well, what we learn is there is popular support for Hezbollah, and we learned that Hezbollah is confident, it's strong, and it's powerful. It remains intact, you know, even in spite of all the hasbara that they're trying to pump out to say how weakened Hezbollah is and how they're not able to be politically as effective. All of that is washed away with this one gathering. What you've seen is defiance, unity, you've seen resilience, and you can see the determination of the General Secretary named Qasim in his vows to fight on, and his commitment to the resistance, even until martyrdom for himself as well. And of course, Ayatollah Khamenei, we also saw the support coming from that that front. The resistance will continue, he said. Of course, people like Sheikh Zakzaki I mentioned, but other leaders, lots of the IRGC and the Islamic Republic's leaders were there, and other dignitaries who all hold Sayyid Nasrallah in great esteem have all shown, and the Yemenis, not least of all the Yemenis, they've shown that actually they are also resilient and united and in defiance to American hegemony. Of course, the Americans are trying to embed themselves in Lebanon, but they're going to find that, I think, that they are going to fail in their efforts to divide and to destroy Lebanon from within, because that's the main tactic that Israel has now got. They can't defeat the Hezbollah movement or the Lebanese people militarily. They've seen that. So their next effort now is all invested in trying to divide and destroy internally. And that's, I think, where Hezbollah's main concentration has been to defend. But on the borders, don't forget, we've got Daesh, the ISIS fraternity, all the Anglo-Zionist-backed Julani types. They're now trying to hem in Hezbollah from one side, and of course the Israelis, who are so depleted they can't face Hezbollah in any effective way. They may try to get this kind of ragtag organization in Syria to somehow try to give Hezbollah problems as well, but I think that they're going to find it's a very hard nut to crack, and I guess all we can do is that the legacy of Sayyid Nasrallah would be best served by seeing the complete liberation of Lebanon, all of South Lebanon, and the liberation of Palestine, because he's a Shia leader, and the Hasbara and the Takfiris generally try to pump out this division between Shia and Sunni. But Sayyid Nasrallah is a fantastic example of how a Shia dies for the Sunnis of Palestine. That in itself is another total destruction that he's caused. Even in his death, he's caused destruction of the Western and Israeli plans.
Time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program, and stay safe to the both of you. Batul Subeiti, activist and political analyst there, and also Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political analyst, both joining us from London. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your OLP Spotlight program. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ribbi. كثير فما